Well, good evening, everybody. I am Jacob Winograd, host of the Biblical Anarchy Podcast, here for another LCI Green Room live stream for open and unscripted conversations. Here on kind of like part two of Mises Caucus Week, we're here to talk with Dr. Michael Rechtenwald, who is the Mises Caucus endorsed candidate for seeking the nomination to run for president under the Libertarian Party banner. Professor Rechtenwald, thanks for being here. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you? It's good to be here.
Yeah, I'm glad to have you back on. I had you on, I forget exactly when, sometime last year, before a lot of the craziness set in. It was pretty shortly, early on after your announcement. And I also got to see you a few weeks back in PA, where you had a very good showing at that debate with the infamous Dr. Belay, who I have no idea where that guy came from. That was that was something else. I don't know if anyone's watched that debate. If you go to that debate and actually listen to the part where you hear someone yelling at him from the crowd that saying you fired all the nurses, that was me. Because I just could not believe the insanity of what that guy was saying. That was a good time. So happy that you're here. I've been following you since before you ran for president, and it's been exciting to see you dip your hat into politics and into the Libertarian Party. Here at the onset here, just give a little bit of introduction just for those who might not be super familiar with you. Just kind of explain again your background, why you're running for president, what your campaign's about.
Yeah, sure. So, yeah, I'm Michael Rechtenwald, and I'm a former NYU professor, author of 12 books, Mises Institute scholar, and formerly Hillsdale College Distinguished Fellow. So I am, I think I've told my story many times about cancellation from the left, and then now cancellation from the right most recently. So I've been canceled by the left and right.
Perfectly balanced, as all things should be.
Yeah. So, I don't know how much you want me to go into any background. It's just kind of like, it's kind of old news now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To talk to us about your the presidential run. I mean, you've been on here to talk about it before, but that was early on, and things are kind of taking shape now. And a campaign is sort of something that evolves the longer it's going on. So why are you running? What's the message that you're trying to put out there? Obviously, here at the Libertarian Christian Institute, we're a nonprofit, and we can't make endorsements. But you're trying to solicit the support, the contributions and votes from people like me and other libertarians and other Christians. So just kind of, give people the basic, elevator pitch of what you're doing and what is Wreck the Regime, as your slogan goes.
Yeah. And I don't have my background up tonight because I was, I packed it away for a trip, but anyway, it's Wreck the Regime, REC, the regime. And so I'm running to represent maximum liberty. I think the party needs to represent maximum liberty, and that is anarcho-capitalism. And also, I am representing the strategy for reaching liberty, maximum liberty, and that is decentralization. So I am running because I was asked to run by the Mises Caucus. And since I've gotten in it, I've really gotten my sea legs in terms of what I stand for. And I've made it very clear that I am the most radical candidate in the race by a long shot, because I am the only anarcho-capitalist in the race. And I'm not hiding that. I think that's what we need. We need absolutely bold messaging, because we're not going to get anywhere by saying, no, we need to have a limited government. I mean, that's not going to sell anybody. Nobody wants to hear that. It's not exciting. It's not a goal. That's just a way station at best. So I'm running to inspire the party to come out against the state totally. And what it would mean to have a fully private property society.
Yeah, no, I was actually just talking about this a little bit when I had Aaron Harris on last night, chair of the Mises Caucus after Heiss stepped down. And, you know, with the candidates up there, there's not many ANCAPs. You're the only one that I think Josh says he's an anarchist at heart, but he's not running he's running more of a sort of America First sort of platform more so than what
I'm not sure if he's running at all, but that's another question.
Right. So the but yeah, I mean, so, and, you know, obviously, so I host the Biblical Anarchy podcast, and so I sort of talk a lot about anarcho-capitalism and sort of, you know, I'm tackling it from two different angles, obviously, from a, you know, political angle and also a religious one. But you're a perfect person to talk to about the political angle of this. And what I love about what you're doing is that it's not, you know, you're being honest with people. This is not so much about you have delusions of winning the presidency and, you know, somehow signing like an executive order that ushers in some sort of anarchist utopia tomorrow. This is more about getting a message out and, right, and educating people on both the truth of politics, the truth of the state, the truth about economics, and also a viable, you know, political strategy to move towards that. I want to focus first on the theory, because this is, you know, kind of your bread and butter. You're someone who, you know, has written a lot about this. You know, when someone hears the term anarcho-capitalism, they, you know, if they haven't heard this before, it sounds like gobbledygook to them. They're like, what the heck? They're like anarchism, capitalism, these things don't seem to equate. So what the heck are you talking about? So if someone has never heard of anarcho-capitalism before, you know, give maybe like a couple minute summary of what that is, what the implications of that political ideology are.
Yeah, I mean, it's an ideology in which we have the privatization of all functions, inclusive of what we call protection functions by the state. And we'd have private property in all things. In other words, we wouldn't have state runs public property. We wouldn't have a monopoly over force by the state. And it's free market, and that is, it regards every person's value in the marketplace. Everybody is free to exchange in the marketplace, and it gets rid of this idea that we need the state to support us. The state is actually a parasite, as I've said it many times. It sucks the lifeblood out of capital, out of the public, out of the taxpayer, and it doesn't provide anything in return other than disaster in its attempts to run the military industrial complex around the world and prop up proxy wars and all this type of stuff. That's just, you know, this is peak statism we're dealing with right now. We're dealing with the largest state in the history of humanity, and so we need to take a serious approach to making it disappear. And the best approach that I think that is viable in these circumstances is to decentralize and to try to wrest power away from the central government at the local level, vesting it in ourselves locally, and resisting and rejecting federal mandates and laws. Because this is a way that we weaken it from the bottom. We're not going to capture it at the top right now. That's just not going to happen. It happened in Argentina, and it happened on this particular message, with this particular message, anarcho-capitalism. That's what Milei ran on. So this is not like it's this is a North Star that we need to have in front of us so that we are following the right path.
Yeah, I certainly agree with a lot of what you're saying there. I feel like a lot of people make this error of when we talk about anarcho-capitalism and privatizing everything, they don't hear those words, right? They hear, oh, you want to abolish courts, and you want to abolish security, and you want to abolish, you know, things that people like that exist in our society. And they just can't conceptualize that, well, no, we can have all of these things. They just don't need to be provided by a single monopoly. I mean, and already
that's all
right. You know, and I think the biggest argument in favor of anarcho-capitalism, because people have a hard time understanding, like, well, how can there be competing? Like, they understand competition in the market if it's like Apple and Android, or if it's Disney and Amazon, but they don't understand competition in political structures like courts and security and things like that. But we already have that. America exists in a state of anarchy from Canada and from Mexico and from, you know, other nations. They have different, you know, courts and stuff. Now they have, you know, I'm not a globalist, so I don't like international law, but that's maybe like they have contracts between different countries for settling disputes among them. And so it's not like they're always at war with each other. And I would say, to the extent they are at war with each other, it's because they're too big. And so decentralization seems like the right path forward, because, you know, we both come from the left, and I wonder if you're as aggravated as I am at how suddenly it seems like in the last 4 or 5 years, the left suddenly doesn't care about monopolies anymore. Like, I remember the left being, you know, the ones who were constantly crying about, you know, corporate monopolies in all different areas of the private sector. And really, it's not the private sector, it's the corporate sector. But they don't seem to care about that anymore. And people don't realize, it's like, well, if you don't like monopolies in the market because the government's picking winners and losers, well, then why would you want monopolies when it comes to how we settle disputes and you know, arbitrate property rights? It just seems to me, and there are, and people have questions. Like, listen, we have answers to your questions. Yes. So many people have written on this. It's like, I mean, I think, you know, you and I are both not just ANCAPs, but we would say we're Hoppe and, you know, ANCAPs, where I think Hoppe has written some of the best stuff on the private production of defense and private law.
It's all been laid out. I mean, I you know, it's kind of hard to reiterate it all in short sound bites, but it's all been worked out. And, you know, most of the time when we have a conflict with somebody, we prefer it not to go to the government courts. We prefer it to be dealt with by private companies that arbitrate between them, like insurance companies. Like yesterday, somebody just hit my car. They started backing out while I was driving down the road and smacked my car.
Oh.
I don't want this to go to court. I want it to be arbitrated between the two insurance companies. This is exactly the kind of arbitration. Most things could be settled in civil court or in civil arbitration. That can be private. It doesn't have to be the state at all. In fact, we all would prefer when things are arbitrated by private companies rather than by the state.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, talk a little bit about the decentralization message, because some people might, because I think that's really the key in connecting the philosophy that you and I are both espousing in terms of political philosophy and connecting that to why you're even in politics, because people might be confused. It's like, well, if you're an anarchist and you just think we should abolish the state, well, then why are you running for president of the United States? And what kind of political strategy could there even be that would be, you know, in accordance with your espoused philosophy?
Yeah, I mean, look, let's be real. If it was a top-down job, it would take an autocrat to undertake it, really. Because there's not any government officials that are going to vote to do away with their jobs. So it's hamstrung by this democratic process, right? So there's no way to get rid of the state from the top down, because the people are, that are part of the state are going to object, and they're the people that have the vote. So now you can get rid of things that are the prerogative of the president, obviously. And I think there's a huge amount of glut, but I don't think it's going to happen that way in the United States in particular. I think our way of approaching this is from the decentralized point of view. And that is, the closer we get to localized government controlling the main affairs of our life, the better and the closer we are to full private property society. So localization leads to full privatization. And what is the function of this? This is to get power vested in people locally to be able to live as we please within the confines of the NAP, of course, and not to be imposed upon by this federal government. This is the only way to choke it off from the ground up, to basically deprive it of its breath by virtue of eliminating it from our local communities. I don't know how else to put it. There's so many different ways. I guess I could skin the cat, but
yeah, no, I think that's put well. You know, we not only can we not, I mean, I think there's people will look to Malay and say, why can't we do that here? Like, well, I mean, we're talking about just such a different scale and such a different backdrop. Like, you know, Argentina had already kind of gone through major political and economic turmoil and collapse, and it's a much smaller country with less, you know, I mean, not that, I mean, there was a lot of like socialist program and whatnot, but I don't think it had the same level of maybe like bureaucracy and deep state and, you know, stuff like that we have here in America. Just the scale of, you know, of it is, it's not an apples to apples situation. And, right, you know, rather we have to, you know, almost like we first need to get back to not having to fight against the giant behemoth of a, you know, of the federal government, and just, you know, hey, let's bring the fight home to just fighting up against our local state and local municipal governments, and we're gonna have a much better time, you know fighting against those and privatizing those than we are going to be, you know, from Washington DC you know, trying to, you know, not just end the the government's role here, but like, I mean, the American Empire, the sun never sets on it, so to speak. It's got its hand over all you know, thumbprint pretty much all over the world, you know. A lot of,
can you give me a minute to, I just got to, I texted you something. If you could put me on hold for a minute, I got to run.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Not a problem.
I'll be right back.
Yep. So while Rechtenwald is, walking away to deal with something quick, when he gets back, I want to talk a little bit about the, cancellation that he went through, which, you know, I think a lot of people are going through cancellations over, you know, foreign policy and issues pertaining to that. We see Candace Owens recently departing from the Daily Wire, and we see, you know, Rechtenwald's gone through his own, you know, personal and professional sacrifices because of stances on that subject. You know, it's while we're waiting for him to come back, I'll also plug for everyone listening here live. The LCI Green Room is a new show, you know, sort of stream that we at the Libertarian Christian Institute started a few weeks ago, and a couple months ago. And if you go back and watch some of that older content, there's actually a debate that I did with Jack Lloyd on the subject of Israel that I think that you know, people listening, if you're fans of me and fans of Rechtenwald, you would highly enjoy that. Professor, thanks for joining us back again. Hope you're, everything's fine. The subject I want to talk about next, which relates to what I was just saying, you know, people have been talking a lot about the departure of Candace Owens from the Daily Wire, which, you know, as much as the, you know, Jeremy Boring and Ben Shapiro don't want to answer any questions about it, we all know the reason that she was let go. And yeah, it was because of her positions on Israel and all that. And you're not unfamiliar to facing consequences professionally and politically because of your stances on Israel and foreign policy. And that's a major part of your platform as well, is, you know, bringing the troops home, ending foreign aid,
right,
you know, and stuff. And Israel is kind of central to all of that. Can you describe to people just sort of, you know, briefly the, you know, sort of what happened when you started to just speak your mind, you know, basically saying, hey, maybe we should not be indiscriminately, you know, blowing up Palestinian children, you know, as a response to what Hamas did?
Yeah, I mean, I was making these kinds of remarks on social media and started getting flack. Particularly, I got flack immediately from my publisher at the time, and they said, your criticisms of Israel, we can't abide that. You're going to have to tone that down or else we're going to have to talk. And so I said, yeah, sure. And went on with what I was saying. And then I got like a second email saying, you know, this is your last warning. If you don't stop this criticism of Israel, we're going to have to cut ties with you as an author. So I said, that's it. I said, forget it. You don't have to forget it. You don't have to cut ties with me. I'll cut them with you right now. And so I said, you know, I won't be publishing with you any further. And then I got a similar but unexplained treatment from Hillsdale. And I think it had to do with running as a libertarian in the first place. And then when I started to criticize the policy of Israel and their behavior and the onslaught in Gaza, they canceled that. So, yeah, those were two pretty significant sources of income. And so they're both, yeah, so I gave those up.
Yeah. I mean, I just want to say, I mean, it's, and again, it's like, I can't from my LCI position endorse a candidate, but just on a personal level, I couldn't help but want to support you in everything that you're doing, not just with this campaign, but just in the future. I think it takes a person of conviction who's deeply committed to their principles and to speaking truth to not cave to the kind of pressure that you were submitted to. So people like you, people like Candace Owens, you know, people like Dave Smith, those who are willing to, you know, go out there and fight these battles in very public, you know, arenas with very real stakes on the line. I think it speaks volumes, I think, to
well,
just how committed you are to
there's
this.
People's lives on the line, people being killed. They're suffering a lot more than what I'm suffering. Okay.
Yeah.
So if I can't be the person who stands for them, then who am I? What good am I?
Yeah.
Those people are the people that are being butchered. These poor people are being destroyed. It's unconscionable. I can't take it. I mean, it's just beyond words, you know. And so it's the most brutal onslaught of a captive civilian population in modern history, as far as we know. And it isn't about hating his, you know, Jewish people or Israel. I don't even use the word Zionism very much. I just want to talk about behavior. And yeah, I don't care what ideology perpetrates it. Let's look at what it is and what it's doing. And it's just beyond the pale. So excuse me for getting worked up. It's just something.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's something we should be worked up about. I find it incredibly frustrating that, and yeah, the ideology shouldn't matter. I guess like a slight nitpick. I get the point of what you're saying. Like it's like you care about the suffering more than the ideology. I think the ideology is what is causing so many people to turn a blind eye to the suffering because they've been programmed.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Oh no, no. Yeah, what I meant to say was I don't care what your ideological justifications for this are. You know, so what I'm trying to say is, yeah, we need to cut. We need to undercut that ideology immediately.
Yeah, 100% agree. It's, you know, I mean, I have, you know, listen, I have Jewish family. I grew up with a dad who converted to Christianity from Judaism. I remember my grandmother before she died, and I called her my bubby because that's Yiddish for grandmother. And she spent years in Israel and would travel back and forth. And, you know, I think some people just don't get it. It's like, we don't hate the Jewish people. I don't even hate the nation of Israel any more than I hate the nation of America. I hate these governments, and I hate these, you know, people in power who are deciding for, you know, I often think these people in power don't actually even believe in these ideologies. I think they weaponize these ideologies to control the masses so that they can hold on to their power, so that they can line their pockets, and they're willing to do whatever it takes, even putting people into the meat grinder of war
to
further their agendas and death. I mean, it's just absolutely horrific. I mean, it's like,
this is what statism sanctions, because people would never accept a non-state actor doing these kinds of acts. They would never accept that for a half second, but because it's a state, it's now somehow exempt for these people. And if that is the statist ideology, that's what works. That's how it is inoculating itself from what would be considered crimes against humanity for any other agent on Earth. But it's the statism that allows this. And then there's, in the case of Israel, there's religious, of course, there are religious ideological threads that run through, of course, Christianity and certain segments of Christianity, like the Christian Zionists, who drive me out of my mind.
I've seen some of your commentary on the Zionists, especially immediately after the conflict broke out. And it's 100% a problem within Christianity, especially within the evangelical world. I know you're running a political campaign, and you have to be sensitive to the fact that not everyone who's in the Libertarian Party or in the American population is Christian, and you don't want to be out there like trying to be a preacher in the world of politics. It's not your role.
But I will tell you what my values and my beliefs are. If you ask,
right, 100%.
I'm going to be 100% honest about everything.
Yeah, 100%. And I think, you know, it's I'm especially appalled, you know, from a Christian perspective, how much the term Christ is King is trying to be spun as being anti-Semitic or spun to be some kind of like, you know, hateful thing to say. It's like, no, it's like, it's quite the opposite. It's like, Christ is my King, which means the state isn't. I mean, I think this just goes back to, you know, in the Old Testament, in 1 Samuel 8, when Israel asks for a king, God, through Samuel, warns them, like, you don't want a king. First of all, I'm your king. Second of all, this human king you're asking for, he's going to take the best of your harvest, the best of your animals and livestock. He's going to take your children and make your children fight on the front lines of his wars, and you are going to be his slaves.
Yeah,
I mean, and that's straight from the Bible. Like, that is 100% a crystal clear definition of the state, is it not? That they take from us, they make us fight and die in their wars, and we essentially become enslaved to them. Mm-hmm. And you know, and listen, like, again, I know you have to talk to everybody, but you know, I feel like, you know, I would love to see you get the opportunity, you know, after DC, to take this message out. And when you're talking to people and these subjects come up, like, I think Christians need to hear this message, you know, and it needs to be a tough message of like, listen, like if you are a Christian, you need to understand that Christ is king and he doesn't condone this senseless violence. There's nothing in the Bible that says, you know, you can't murder innocent people, but someone because they wear a badge or because they were elected or because democracy that, you know, or because of your ideology that suddenly it becomes okay. No, murder is murder. Theft is theft. And Christ is king and the state is not.
Yes, the king is Christ. And that means the state is not king and means they, and therefore you should not submit to it. That you should not submit to it. And that's a challenge for, I think, Christians in particular. I think God wants us to be free. Yeah. Why? Because when we're free, then we're full moral agents and we're able to make real moral choices. When we're not free, we are not moral agents. Strictly, we are being coerced and then we're being manipulated and used, and therefore we can't choose as well. We can't choose. Our choices are sort of determined. So I think God wants us to be free. Yeah. And that means free of the state. I think this is a principled Christian view because, as you said, the king is not the state. The state is not supposed to reign supreme over us. This is hard for people to believe, but it's true.
Yeah. And we're called to, you know, have dominion over the world, be good stewards over the planet, over
and
the
not
animals,
over each other.
Over
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, Jesus tells his apostles, listen, like, don't be like the Gentiles who are trying to, he literally uses the word archontes, which is like the Greek kind of precursor for arc, you know, so we're anarchists because we're against arcing, and Jesus tells his apostles, don't be archontes, don't try to be rulers over one another, but rather you should be servants to all, which is like, isn't that such a, I mean, that's obviously speaking to like theological concepts as well, but also like, isn't that kind of what the free market is? It's like, yes. I don't rule over you. You don't rule over me.
If I serve you by making something for that you want.
Exactly.
Basically. And yeah. Vice versa. And we exchange them peaceably on a marketplace and without coercion or preemption by the state, but without them interfering, without them trying to stand in the way of this transaction, which is a voluntary transaction and which should not be forbidden or put or taxed or otherwise coerced or so forth by the state. And that's what they do. They get in between as many transactions as they can. First of all, they do it with their money, okay? And then they do it with their regulations. And then they do it with prohibitions. And all of this is very, very vital to get to the bottom of.
Yeah. And, you know, one thing that you're very good at talking about, and I think you're the only candidate that's doing a good job of bringing this into the conversation, and libertarians sometimes have not liked you for saying this, but I think Dave says it best. You know, conservatives need to learn a libertarian lesson, and libertarians need to learn a conservative lesson. The state is also engaged in trying to weaponize culture.
Yes.
And so you rightfully bring up that, you know, although yes, in a, you know, an ANCAP society, we wouldn't be trying to create mechanisms to go around and, you know, rule over other people. That does not mean that we should be celebrating or uncritical of the fact that the state is clearly involved in you know, well, I mean, there's a couple things. There's like they're weaponizing, trying to bring people across the border to cause demographic change here. And then they're also, you know, trying to pharmaceutically bombard children under the guise of like gender affirming care. And it's like,
I mean, look, it's in the state, you know, in the last budget bill that was just passed, the $1.2 trillion, there were hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars dedicated to trans issues. And that means the trans gender surgery and affirming gender affirming care, as they call it. All of that was in the budget. So that is the state putting its finger on the cultural pulse and actually putting its finger into the game. And that's got to stop. I mean, we have a state that's actually trying to encourage transgenderism as such. And also, of course, encouraging unmitigated immigration through artificial stimulation vis-a-vis social welfare handed out through NGOs, getting their money from the Office of Refugee Resettlements and distributing in the last, in over a 15-year period, over $475 billion to be handed out to immigrants. So this would induce them to immigrate across the border. And of course, there's the war on drugs, which creates the cartels, which creates the black market, and then creates the cartels. That has to end. And of course, the foreign interventionism that's caused all of these people to immigrate or want to immigrate in the first place, thanks to policies of the U.S. and the Middle East, and going back to Reagan in Central America. So all of this has produced this crisis. And so it has to be treated, I think, from a property perspective, first of all, but from a moral perspective, too, that you induce artificially all of this, these people to move to another country using artificial inducements. This is doing them no favors at all. This is actually harming those people.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree 100%. And I'm, you know, I used to be more in the, I guess, like, I don't know the right way to label it. I think people think that the default libertarian position is that you should be for open borders, which, like, I don't know. Like, I guess if you were a minarchist or classical liberal, maybe I could try to defend that. But as an ANCAP, yeah. I'm like, well, first of all, I don't believe in government borders. So that's not really the default libertarian position by my understanding of libertarianism, which taken to its full extent is anarcho-capitalism. But beyond that, it's like, you know, I'm not even sure anymore, because I used to think, well, it's not the default position, but maybe open is better than restricted. I'm kind of agnostic on the issue now, because I just think, like, you know what, like, you know,
well, let me just say this about it.
Go ahead.
The people that are minarchists and an open borders people, they don't want the state to have any control over the border itself, but they cede its control over public, so-called public property by default.
True. Yeah.
So this is a contradiction. Sorry. That's a contradiction within your philosophy.
Yeah.
And that right there shows you that it's not consistent at all. And that's the problem. So what we're left with in the presence of a state, or second best solutions only. Don't pretend like open borders is some sort of idyllic, you know, utopian and far extremely good position by default. That's ridiculous. The fact of the matter is that open borders is still state control of public property, which I don't believe they earned. I don't think they rightfully hold that property. So yeah. I think that's the property of people that have paid for it. Now, so that's why I try to say that my whole immigration policy is all privatization. Privatize the process and privatize the borders and privatize the land that people would enter into.
Yeah.
And then decide whether people are allowed in or not, because they would have to be invited.
Yeah. And if you had, you know, I also like the idea of some kind of sponsorship as a interim between, you know, what you're proposing and where we're at now. Because, like, listen, obviously the economy does require some movement of people, and you don't want to hurt the economy by becoming too restrictive. And it's like, we don't really trust the state to properly monitor that, but nor should we allow the state to then weaponize their unearned control to serve their ends. Rather, we should try to provide some kind of outlet for market, control to be inserted back into the equation, because open or closed, while the state border exists, it's a perversion of what the free market would produce. Like, no one, anytime a libertarian is looking at this and they just try to act like, whatever, it's just the free movement of people, I'm like, you're going to tell me this is a free market outcome? Like, really? Yeah. Like, come on. Like, it's there's just no way it's a free
outcome. It's not a free market outcome. It's insane. It's being propped up in so many different ways that it's obviously not. It's a state functionary. It's a state constructed situation. So everything about it is not free market. So the movement of people under these conditions is not free market movement at all. People generally don't want to leave where they grow up. I mean, frankly, people like where they were born. And I'm not saying that's like a law of nature, but it's pretty much a pattern that you can discern. And so likewise, I think people would love to flourish where they find themselves. And I'm not saying that they might. There would be plenty of people that would say, I'd prefer to go somewhere else. I agree. You should be able to do that. But what I'm getting at here is that the state has distorted all of these problems through interventions, through the drug wars, through the inducement of migration vis-a-vis social welfare payouts. It's rigged this game to go this way. So it is not a free market in movement at all.
Yeah, 100%. And I think the American people are just not going to be won over by arguments that fly in the face of reality. So if we're just trying to tell them open borders is just the natural state of like it respecting people's rights, it's like you're almost telling the American people to like just ignore the naked reality in front of them of what's happening, which is clearly not natural. And it doesn't mean like I have sympathy for a lot of the people who are caught up in this migrant crisis and coming here. I think they're victims of the state. I just don't think that I think we should be trying to reduce the amount of aggression, reduce the amount of victims, and reduce the amount of distortions, and not be like, well, because they were victimized, now we have to just let them all in uncritically and allow further, violations of rights to happen. It'd be like the American people have to be victimized because these people were victimized. Like two wrongs don't make a right. Like we all know this, and we need to find a more, civilized market, market-based solution for dealing with this. And the ideas that like you talk about and Hoppe talks about and Dave Smith talks about, in terms of like sponsorship and privatization, decentralization, these seem to me to be the actual libertarian answers. And I think, having someone on the libertarian ticket to go out there and say that would do a lot of good, I think, towards, the branding of the movement overall, compared to some of the past people who have I think it would.
It's ironic that one of the candidates keeps saying that we'll never get anywhere unless we're open borders, out front, open borders, that we'll have no choice or no chance of impressing the American people unless we go with no borders immediately. And, yeah, I mean, there's other ways, and these are principled stands. A principled stand is a private property stand, a privatization model that we should look towards and try to get to as soon as we can.
Yeah, and I think we're drawing to a close here, and I want to ask you just a couple questions about just the what you're looking forward to with the rest of this campaign in DC and whatnot. But it's just again going back to that idea of like if we're called to be stewards over creation. Mm-hmm. Well, I think this is where like some Christians I think just kind of think we don't need to worry about economics, we don't need to worry about politics, and I'm like you couldn't be more wrong. Like how can we be good stewards? How can we fulfill the God-given mandate of having stewardship and dominion over the world if we don't understand economics? Like we have to understand economics. It is the study of how people, manage and use scarce resources. And so if we don't have sound economics, if we don't try to structure society and from the ground up and local level on that understanding, then we're going to mismanage God's creation. And that's not good for us. And that's bringing dishonor to God rather than honor and glory like we're supposed to.
Indeed. And one of the main things we should teach people, and I don't know why this comes to me, is look, supply is demand. If I make something to put in the marketplace, that's a demand on something else. That's all. So supply is demand. This is how we get it. We get bounty by allowing freedom of trade, a freedom internally and, you know, across boundaries. Free trade is another issue that puts pressure on the migration issue, because it thwarts development in these developing countries by having trade restrictions on these companies. And I would lift the embargo against Cuba immediately. This is a punitive, nasty, unbelievable, horrible policy.
Oh yeah,
you want to invite somebody into the free market? Why would you close them off to it?
There's something almost aggravating about the assumed moral superiority of some of the open border types, because they don't realize that, like, they're doing in a sense a disservice to the origins, the homelands of these people, because they're sort of enabling. It's like, you know, I feel like if we're going to call ourselves libertarians and we're going to say as anarcho-capitalists, and I would argue also with Christians, we should be against empire, against imperialism, against tyranny, then why would we support policies that just enable the tyranny of our government across the world, as you mentioned, including Central and South America? We should have compassion for these people, but we need to find a way to lift the tide for them in their home regions, which means pulling our government and our militaries and our intelligence operations back out of those areas to stop meddling and the war on drugs. And then, as you said, free trade, free market economics, that is the tide that lifts all boats. And that's, I think, a much more compassionate outlook. But you know what it requires? A lower time preference and just an understanding of, like, not being useful idiots for the ruling elites.
Yeah.
That's the only way I can think to put it.
Yeah, that's right.
Let's talk about here. I don't want to be sensitive to your time. I know you've been traveling the country and you're very busy, and I appreciate you taking the time to talk with me and my audience today. We're coming up, we're at the end of March, so we're about 2 months away now from a little less than 2 months away from DC, where the nomination will go down by the delegates that go there for the Libertarian Party to vote for who's going to represent the Libertarian Party banner when the time comes. How confident are you in that? And how's the experience been? And what are you looking forward to should you seek the nomination in terms of how this is going to, you think your campaign can bolster? We already talked about how, like, we were going to bring a message to people, and that's good. But how can your campaign help bolster the Libertarian Party and movement and push it into the future to be more effective?
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole point, is to further the movement of liberty and to expand liberty in our lifetimes. And so I think that this particular campaign, the reason why it's positioned to do so is because it has been the most utterly principled and extremely bold in terms of its messaging comparatively. I'm not talking about, we got to get eliminate government. This stuff is not going to excite anybody. And it's not really getting to the bottom of the matter. It assumes that the state is some benign entity that we just need benevolent rulers to manipulate it. It assumes that the state is benign in itself, and that is wrong. We can't tell people that. We got to tell them the truth. There's nothing benign about the state. And if the Constitution was effective in creating the kind of state minimalist government that the founders were looking for, it would have worked. It didn't. It doesn't work because statism grows. States grow. They have a tendency to expand, and they have a tendency to increase power. And this is just endemic to them. So I'm running to wreck the regime, as you just put up, and and I'm running because I want this party to be represented by maximum liberty, not halfway liberty, not minarchism, not... I want us to be bold and say, this is what we want. How can we ever reach it if we don't ever say that's what we want?
Yeah.
We can't do it. I mean, I follow as my blueprint is Murray Rothbard's essay, The Case for a Radical Idealism. That's my blueprint for my campaign. We have to, we can't run on small government in theory or gradualism in theory. We have to run on abolition in theory, and then we accept gradualism in practice.
Yeah, that's exactly what Rothbard said.
Yeah.
As you just pointed out.
Yeah, I mean, we can't run on this minimalist thing because then we get nothing. So we need to run on the boldest message we can. I'm just following Rothbard's lead.
Yeah.
Not his lead as having run for office, but his advice, which I think is absolutely right.
Yeah. And I think it's just what you're getting at here is that if we don't lead with the truth, then everything that we do flowing from that is going to be skewed. Yeah. Like if we don't tell people we want maximum liberty, because I feel like I always understand what you mean when you say that. And I think some people might think it's just like it sounds cool. Like, no, like you're saying we don't want half liberty. We don't want three quarters liberty. We don't want 99% liberty. What we want, what our God-given rights are, right, is 100% liberty. Now, we can choose, and I think we should as Christians choose to submit to him with that liberty.
Yeah,
but the point is that state has no right to restrict those rights or those liberties. And if we are telling people, oh, we just want minimal tyranny. We've given up the game. We have lost before we started. We have to start from the position of no, 100% liberty. And then listen, politically, you know, in terms of, you know, strategy, in terms of, you know, gradualism, we accept the wins as they come, but we don't ever let up in terms of what we're aiming at.
Absolutely. 100%. We couldn't agree more. And so that's been the modus operandi of my campaign, or operandus of my campaign, and that's what I'm continuing to do. I will not relent.
And I just feel like, and I know we're at the end of our time here, but I'm also just so excited. Like, I'm so excited to see you hopefully winning in D.C. and to run a campaign. I'm also just so excited to see you hopefully continue to be a rising star in our movement. Because I've been just personally very inspired by you and, your fighting spirit, your heart, you know, I think it shines through in everything you're doing. And, it doesn't end, in May in DC. It doesn't end in November after the election. The fight for liberty is going to be, you know, ongoing until we get there. And,
I know
you are like me, you're hunkered in for the long haul. So tell people where they can find you, your social media, your website, all that, if they want to find out more, if they want to support you.
It's all at wreckthegregime.com. That's REC, theregime.com. One word. And jump on board. We need help. We could use support of all kinds, volunteers, donations, and so forth. We're trying to keep this message going, and we have to go through the process of the Libertarian Party to get this nomination in order to get this message out as broadly as possible. So that's what I'm trying to do. So go to wreckthegregime.com and give us a hand.
Awesome. Well, thank you again so much, Rechtenwald, for being here today, making the time to talk to us and our audience. And thank you, everybody who tuned in to listen. Of course, please make sure you like this video, you subscribe it, share it around, because if you're like me, you were just inspired to go out there and do what I always say, which is go out, live in peace, and live for Christ. So we'll talk to you all again next time.